I have had the opportunity to travel just a little bit. As Shay mentioned, we lived in Slovakia for about 5 years, and Slovakia, it's kind of Europe is a lot like the United States in one way, and that is that you can go across borders and things like that, and you can see a lot of different kinds of terrain and things. But the difference there is you're moving from one country to the next, very much like we might move from one state to the next here. And so you could go, I could get on a bus and an hour later I could be in a different country. And a few hours later I could be across two or three countries. And so, and there's a lot of history in Europe, and we got to see a lot of things. As a matter of fact, there were times during our time there that I thought, if I have to see one more cathedral, I think I'm going to get sick. You know, now, in reality, I find them rather disturbing, those cathedrals, because they are to some degree icons, sometimes very literally, to something that I find disturbing, to say the least. At a certain point, they're no longer pretty, because I'm thinking about all the things that could have been done to spread the gospel that instead are focused on the gilding of another figure of a saint or something like that. I find that in the very lightest sense of the word, disturbing, perhaps more disgusting than disturbing sometimes. As I've traveled the world, I've had an opportunity to see some impressive things, and that's just one example. Some of the things that I've seen are natural wonders, like the Grand Canyon here in the United States, or Victoria Falls in Africa. You stand and look at those things, and it's almost beyond your ability to fully apprehend. Natural wonders. Other things are man-made, like the Great Wall of China, or Machu Picchu in Peru. And you sit back and you think, how remarkable. The Great Wall of China, a thing that you can see from space, the only human-made thing, as far as I know, that can actually be seen from space. And you think, what an accomplishment that is. Machu Picchu, something that was put together on top of that mountain by people who had none of the modern implements that we might use to build anything of any scale whatsoever, and yet they were able to do something that's so absolutely remarkable as that. And the question that continually comes to my mind, really in both cases, whether we're talking about something that's made by God or something that's made by man, the question that comes to my mind is, why? Now, do you ask that question? Because I ask that question a lot. Why? And by the way, I want you to give yourself permission to ask that question. I want you to give your kids permission to ask that question. It's okay to ask why. Now, I think in God's case, there are reasons perhaps only He could possibly understand why He did all the things that He did. I'll not even pretend, with my finite human ability to comprehend the mind of God, I'll not even pretend to try to guess why He does some of the things that He does. I think that a lot of what He does so that we can enjoy it. Paul told Timothy, God has given us all things wonderfully to enjoy. So I think part of what He's done is to put us in a place where we can appreciate where we live and enjoy that. Further, He's given us some things so that we can know that He is, that He is God. There's an awful lot that we can't know about God from creation. But one thing's for sure, if you take a look at creation, you're supposed to be able to understand that He is. But perhaps the question is even more difficult to answer in some respects when we ask, why do people do the things that they do? Especially, why do they erect these huge edifices? We have some understanding of why the Great Wall of China was built. It was built out of fear as much as anything else. Machu Picchu, I can't possibly tell you why that was built. The various buildings and monuments that exist all over our world were built for various reasons, but almost all of them were built at least partially for one reason, and that is somebody wanted somebody else to remember something. To be remembered is important to us, it seems. It makes me feel good when I come back here to Palm Beach Lakes, and some of you remember that I was here one time before. Some of you don't remember. Oops. It was a pleasure to meet you when I should have been a pleasure to see you again. Well, I don't care because I don't remember you either. But I'm just kidding. Sort of. But it makes us feel good to be remembered. There's a lady here on the front row that I went to college with. we both look a bit different than we did 30 years ago. Oh, I let that number slip, didn't I, Kathy? Sorry about that. But she remembered me. Remembered some silly things that I did. I hope she's forgotten some of the silly things that I did. Oh, she says she hasn't. That is so sad. Barry and Janet Rucker sitting over here. They remember me from, you know, 15, 20 years ago as well. And Barry, this was a surprise to me, you know, to walk into this building yesterday. I look up and there's Barry and Janet. What a neat thing it is for me able to see them. And they look a little bit different, especially Barry. But, you know, but they look enough the same that I remember. And just the remembering of that and just the being remembered by them means something to me. I can appreciate that. There seems to be a strong desire within us to be significant enough that others will remember. Sometimes that transcends just a casual interest in being important in the life of another person to the point where it becomes a sort of craving for immortality. And many of the buildings and monuments that we see that have been erected around the world are a response to somebody's desire to live forever, at least in some sense. They recognize, as Kyle mentioned to us earlier this morning in our sermon time, that we're all going to die. And thus we're going to disappear from this earth in a physical sense. And the good news for us is we've got someplace else that we're going to be for the rest of eternity. But for some people, so connected as we are to the physical, there's this craving to live on in some sense. If one is remembered, they seem to think, in a sense, we're not completely gone. I think we can relate to that on a certain level, can't we? And despite the fact that some of the attempts at immortality seem strained and perhaps misplaced, I think we can at least identify with this desire not to just disappear. In Psalm 135, in verse 13, the psalmist explains, "Your name, O Lord, endures forever. Your renown, O Lord, throughout all ages." Now what the psalmist here is exclaiming is what he believes to be a self-evident reality, and that is that God's always going to be, and not only is God always going to be, but because He's always going to be, He can never be forgotten. His work in this world, the things for which He is known, are so exceedingly impressive that He simply cannot be forgotten. Or can it? Isn't that one of the things that we're struggling with right now as we see that so many people, whether or not they may remember the fact of what has been talked about in the Bible, at least some people do, but they don't really remember what He's done in a way that makes a personal difference to them. Now some people have either forgotten or generations have forgotten to such a degree that people may not even know. I read a statistic several years ago that 87% of the people on the planet can identify the Coca-Cola logo. At that same time, and I don't know how they come about getting these statistics sometimes, but at that time they suggested that only 68% could identify who Jesus was. Now, a lot of people have forgotten. What the psalmist says here is not that no one would forget, but that God is unforgettable in the sense that There's no sense to the idea of forgetting Him. Forgetting Him is ludicrous when you consider what He's done. Note there He says, "Your name endures forever." Not everybody's going to know that name, but the name endures. Your renown, or those things which you've accomplished which are remarkable and are the sorts of things that ought to be remembered forever because they're such scope and significance. Those things endure throughout all ages. He contrasts the God of heaven with the idols of His neighbors, which come and go with the capricious moods of fickle men. Certainly, the gods worshipped by pagans throughout the years have been little more than religious curiosities a few hundred years later. Tell me what you know about Baal or Asherah, Isis and Osiris. Most people, not only here in our own country, but around the world, would struggle to give you any significant information about that. Even those of us who study the Old Testament, we know that the worship of Baal was a problem. Can you tell me anything about Baal? There are a few of you in here who could tell me that Baal, like Asherah, was a god of fertility. You know, you could tell me a few isolated things about that, but most of us have no real thought for them because they have become insignificant. And the psalmist says, our God is not like that. The things that He does are of such significance that it is unreasonable to forget Him. The Lord continues to be known in every generation, not by every person of every generation, sadly, but by every generation. You and I sit here and stand here today worshiping the God of heaven because His name has continued to be preserved in generations past such that that faith has been brought to us. And we have been able to adopt that for our own. The Lord continues to be known. In fact, with the coming of Jesus Christ and the message of the gospel, the scope of the Lord's influence and reputation only expanded. Isaiah the prophet connected the past with the future, what was with what would be, when he said, the Messiah is coming. He seemed to be saying, among other things, the generations yet to come will witness the power and sovereignty of God. Isaiah chapter 52 and verse 15 is one example of that. The prophet says his actions, the actions of this one who will come, will continue to have a profound influence on the world. Now, those people who have sought to memorialize themselves, to attain immortality for generations to come, they do so with a strategy which is very self-directed. They seek immortality by emphasizing self. Jesus's immortality is not based on emphasizing self. Quite the contrary, this God-man is going to accomplish what the world cannot, a lasting memorial, an undying influence, all while de-emphasizing self about as much as any person possibly could. He doesn't know how to do it. I remember watching a movie here several years ago. I can't even remember the name of the movie. Perhaps one of you guys can tell me afterwards. But I think it may have been Mr. Mom, now that I think about it, with Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton's going to take the kids to school, and all the way he's driving up toward the school, his kids are saying, Dad, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. You're not going in the right place. You're not doing this. Finally pulls up to the school after fighting the traffic and things, going the wrong way the whole direction, rolls down the window. There's a lady there standing there, looks at him and says, you're doing it wrong. I think a lot of people in our world take a look at what Jesus has done, and they say, you're doing it wrong. You didn't follow the customary pattern for gathering a following. You didn't follow the customary pattern in terms of being someone of significance. You're not following the customary pattern in terms of having a lasting influence. Strange then, isn't it? Some 2,000 years later, anyone who might have said those words to Jesus is long gone, and we have no idea who they might be. But Jesus and His influence continue on. Some 800 years after the prophecies of Isaiah the prophet, He was exactly as Isaiah had portrayed Him. Indeed, there were some who might well have put Him in the category with Thutis and Judas, Acts chapter 5, verses 35 through 38. Just another failed revolutionary who would soon fade from memory. Isn't that the advice that Gamaliel gave those who would try to make a big stir about these Christians who were coming and upsetting the apple cart? Don't worry, he says. At least this is half of what he says. Don't worry. Don't you remember? This has happened many times before. People come up, they gather a following, fizzles out, they go away, everybody forgets. I can think of, says Gamaliel, a couple of examples of many. That's what people thought would happen to Jesus as well. Of course, Gamaliel also did mention one very important thing, and that is, if this is from God, it would be futile to try to fight it anyway. Not exactly a blinding statement of faith, but nonetheless, very accurate. Jesus is the real thing. And the real thing lasts, even if the real thing makes no attempt to self-immortalize. Jesus of Nazareth did not follow the ordinary path to greatness, nor did His end exclaim, success! If I remember the story, in the minds of many, many people, at its pinnacle, at its apex, at its climax, the hero dies. This is not normally the way we like to see things conclude. Of course, you and I now know, again, as we studied during our worship hour today, that this was not the end. Not by a long shot. Nonetheless, when Jesus hung on that cross some 2,000 years ago and exclaimed, "It is finished," that's not how we expect the story to turn out by those who are going to be significant in their influence in this world over time. However, ultimately, of course, He proves Himself victorious. It is He who stands out as the central figure of human history. It is He who will be remembered throughout all generations. Perhaps you're familiar with this poem. I've heard it a number of times in my life. I've heard it a number of different ways, and at first I thought, well, you know, the preachers are all, they just need to get on the same page here. And as I did a little research to find this poem, which I'd heard so many times, I got on the internet. What did people do before they had the internet? How in the world did you find stuff? I have such tremendous respect for people who did what we're doing today without the benefit of some of the resources that we have today. But I found this poem entitled "A Solitary Life," and I found about five or six different versions. Nobody can really even agree to whom to attribute the thing. Most of the sources I found said it may be adapted from a sermon by James Allen Francis. And it goes like this. You've heard it. He was born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant. He grew up in another village where he worked in a carpenter shop till he was about 30. Then, for 3 years, he was an itinerant preacher. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never had a family or owned a home. He didn't go to college. He never lived in a big city. He never traveled more than 200 miles from the place of his birth. He did none of the things that usually accompany greatness. He had no credentials but himself. He was only 33 years old when public opinion turned against him. His friends abandoned him. One of them denied him. He was turned over to his enemies and went through a mockery of a trial. He was nailed to a cross between two common criminals. While he was dying, his executioners gambled for his clothing, the only property he had on earth. When he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave through the pity of a casual friend. 20 centuries have come and gone, and today he is the central figure of the human race. "I am well within the mark," says the author, "when I say that all the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned put together have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as that one solitary life." When Jesus left this earth, he had set in motion a series of events that would define not only his own memory, but also shape the course of history. I'd like to call your attention today to a few illustrations. And we're not in the auditorium. Not that there's any law about this. You're not in the auditorium. So it'd be perfectly permissible for you to raise your hand and we could just talk together. I'd be thrilled to death if we'd do this. I'm a teacher. I like it when we have interaction in the classroom. So feel free to, as we talk about some of these kinds of things, just add something to the discussion. Because see, I've already heard all of this. I would enjoy this a lot more if I could get something new over the course of our time together. I'd like to mention just a few categories of things. And I'm going to group them together in this way. First of all, Jesus profoundly affected the lives of people who knew Him. Note the following examples of that. John chapter 4. Here we meet, if I had more time, we'd talk about John chapter 3 too, because that discussion with Nicodemus is beautiful. And it's especially beautiful when you put John chapter 3 and John chapter 4 together, because it demonstrates Jesus' ability to interact with people on broad ends of the human spectrum. I mean, here you got Nicodemus. He's a guy, I mean, he is at the top of his game religiously. Quite likely a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, a guy who gets it right. And on the other end of the spectrum, you got this Samaritan woman, and if she would just have committed murder, she would have done about the worst things you possibly could have done in your lives. I mean, she's a pretty good example of somebody who is about as far from having it together as anybody that we can imagine. Jesus interacts quite amiably and powerfully with both. And I love Him for that. I love Him for His ability to do that. I want to be like that. But let's take a look at the story of this Samaritan woman, because we get to see some things here that we don't always get to see. This lady, and I'm using that term rather loosely to describe her, at least on the basis of the way society would have viewed her. She made a mess of her life. Not only that, she's a Samaritan, and you know how the Jews felt about Samaritans. So you can imagine her surprise when she goes to the water to get something to drink, and Jesus interacts with her in very personal sorts of ways. And over a period of time, He talks with her about a variety of different kinds of things. He deals with the subject of prejudice as He discusses with this lady. He deals with worship as He talks with her. But most importantly, He deals with her in such a way that it forces her to grapple with her own spiritual life in ways that do not prevent escape. Jesus is gentle but persistent. As she tries to deflect the discussion, "Where's your husband?" He says. She said, "I don't have a husband." "I'm sorry," said Jesus. "Next customer." "No. No, you don't have a husband. Matter of fact, you've had several. And the one you're with now, you don't have any right to be with." Awkward. Isn't that what we say? That's uncomfortable. "You know, now that you talk about husbands, I've been thinking about worship." That doesn't necessarily follow, does it? "Your people say you got to go down to Jerusalem worship. My people worship over here on Mount Gerizim. Which is it?" You see, this is not Jesus' first day on the job. He knows what she's doing. It's okay. It's all right. We're going to have time to deal with some of this stuff. Jesus says, it's not that simple. Let me tell you something about where things are going. It's not going to be about the place. It's going to be about spirit, truth. By the way, isn't it interesting that in John chapter 3 and chapter 4, two of the most important and most quoted verses among Christians come from the mouth of Jesus in the context of a private conversation with an individual. John 3:16 was said to Nicodemus in the middle of the night, and its lasting influence has lasted. The Samaritan woman gets to hear God is a spirit, and those who worship Him must worship Him in spirit and truth. That's said to one person who was not yet a believer. A person you could not... It picked somebody to be the most likely person to receive that significant information. Samaritan woman would not have been on the list. Jesus reveals indiscriminately powerful truths at every personal connection that He makes. Folks, if we did that, the world would be different. It would. If we couldn't shut up about things of significance, we fill our conversations with trivia. Jesus never did that. Want to know why He was remembered throughout all generations? Maybe that's one of the reasons. Every conversation was packed with significance. I'm sure that Jesus occasionally talked about weather. I'm sure that there are times that Jesus laughed and cut up with His friends and talked about matters which are just part of the human experience. But Jesus took the occasion to talk about matters of consequence. And I think we ought to follow His example in that. The Samaritan woman, after having this conversation with Jesus about things that mattered, leaves Him and goes back to her village. And you remember what she told the people of her village? Which, by the way, she would have no reason to believe they would have paid any attention to her given her lifestyle. But she couldn't help it. She said, this is the New Revised Mark Blackwelder translation of the Scriptures. My apologies. "You've got to meet this guy. He told me everything I ever did. He knows stuff about me I don't even know about myself. I'm more me now than I was when I met him. I'm better for having interacted with him." Jesus profoundly influenced the life of this woman, and through her then influenced the lives of others. The Samaritans came out to hear Jesus because of the exuberance and excitement with which this woman talked about her interaction with him. People came to know Jesus. They came to know themselves. And they came to understand the will of God better because of Him. Zacchaeus was a wee little man. A wee little man was he. Zacchaeus is a guy who had every reason, it appears, to stand on the fringes. As a matter of fact, when we see him, that's what's happened. The problem is, when you're that height, the fringe is not a very good place from which to view. So, he climbs a tree. But he's still on the fringes. Jesus, I love Jesus. I love him for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is I love Jesus because he sees stuff that other people don't see. He looks to the periphery and he finds things of significance there. In Luke chapter 19, he's walking down the road and there's everything around him to occupy his attention. He's got people asking him questions. He's got teaching. He's got important things to do. He's got places to go. And in the midst of all that, he looks up and he sees Zacchaeus hanging from that tree branch. And he engages Zacchaeus in meaningful discussion. Zacchaeus, that's got to scare people anyway, you know. We're wearing name tags around here so we know each other's names. I'm glad for that. When I a lot of times when I first go to a place, I get one of these name tags, I forget it, and somebody comes up and he says, "Hey, Brother Mark, and how do you know me?" Oh, okay, I get the name tag on. Well, Zacchaeus probably didn't have a name tag on. Jesus just knew him. Jesus knew people. It was part of his knowledge was remarkable. He knew who people were. He knew what they were thinking. That's kind of scary. Mark chapter 2. What are you doing reasoning in your hearts? Who can forgive sins but God alone? That's scary. Aren't you glad you know people who can figure out what's going on in your heart at any given time? Might change the way we put things in our hearts, mightn't it? By the way, Jesus still knows. Jesus knew Zacchaeus. Connected with him. Come down here, Zacchaeus. You and I are going to have lunch together today. Your treat. And Zacchaeus comes down and they have this interaction over a period of time. Zacchaeus is shaped by that exposure to Jesus. At the end of the story, and we don't know the end of the story that we have anyway, remember what Zacchaeus says? I'm a changed man. If I've defrauded anybody, I'll pay him back fourfold. You can count on me. It took interaction with Jesus to make that happen. When Jesus interacts with somebody, they change. They're profoundly affected by that. The Pharisees expressed their frustration with his popularity, but you people love Jesus. They were drawn to him. We sometimes get this idea because the story turns out the way it does that there's this group of people who hate him so desperately that they're willing to kill him. We sometimes forget that Jesus was extremely popular with a vast majority of the populace. They express their frustration in John chapter 12, verse 19, when they say, certain people are trying to get at Jesus, and some of the other Pharisees sit back and shake, you see them shaking their head like this. It ain't going to work. Verse 19, you see that you gain nothing. Look, the whole world has gone after him. Even when he selected his apostles, he did not look for those who were obvious candidates for leadership on the world stage. Have you ever stopped? Just one of the great discussions that I've ever enjoyed having is about the apostles and the kind of people that they were when Jesus meets them. You got a bunch of fishermen. You got people, and you think about personal characteristics of people like Peter. Now, Peter's like, I suspect for many of you, my personal favorite because he's so entertaining. You know, there's just no telling what's going to come out of his mouth. You know, you heard Kyle talk about falling asleep in classes. I don't have very many people falling asleep in my classes. It is not because I'm a particularly good teacher. It's because I'm unpredictable. There's just no telling what I'm going to do, and that scares people. That's part of the reason why some of you all are awake now. No telling what he's going to do. Yeah. Peter's that kind of guy. There's no telling what he's going to do, and that's fun. But if you're going to put together a leadership team, it's not what you're looking for. Unpredictability and spontaneity are not two of the top characteristics for leadership. There need to be something else. Of course, Jesus sees within people like Peter something that was not initially obvious. There are other great combinations. You got James and John. I would never put two brothers on the same team. I'm just trying to remember what my brother and I went through when I was growing up. That kid's the dumbest thing I'd ever known when I was growing up. I'm guessing he probably thought the same thing. He turned out to be a pretty decent human being. I'm not exactly sure how that happened. Sons of Thunder. Where do you suppose they got that nickname? Probably for their spirit of cooperation and their mild-mannered attitudes. Yes? You got Matthew the tax collector and Simon the zealot. Now, there's a great combination. One of them, by all intents and purposes, has sold out to the Romans and cooperated with them to, in the minds at least of many, oppress the Jews. Now, we do not know that Matthew was dishonest or that he was doing anything he ought to do. We just know that's the reputation they would have had. That's the category he comes from. That's the box that all the rest of the Jews would have put him in. And then you got Simon the Zealot over here. What do we know about the Zealots? What's mission number one? What's job one for the Zealots? We've got to get these Romans out of here. They have no business being in our country. Whatever methods are necessary in order to make that happen. These are the guerrilla warriors of the Jews. These are the commandos. These are people, at least some of whom, would feel perfectly at liberty to find a Roman soldier or two walking by themselves late at night and a bunch of them beat on them, jump on them and kill them. They would feel that was justified under the rules of warfare. Okay, so you put these two together in the same band of 12 disciples. Jesus really needed some lessons on recruitment and human resource management. And of course, Jesus is able to take this group of people and change them and then start changing people through them and ultimately change the entire world. As a matter of fact, it's this same group of people later on that the enemies of Christ in Thessalonica would say, "These who have upset the world have come here also." They're making a mess out of things. It was so good the way we had it before. Now, the truth of the matter is, and you've heard this before, they accused the disciples to some degree of turning the world upside down. The problem is, the world was already upside down. The disciples were trying to turn it right side up, and that doesn't work very well in the minds of people who are satisfied with the status quo. The Apostle Paul, on the road to Damascus. Now, here's a guy, I'm guessing that if I'm thinking, you know, we need somebody else to join us in this fight to promote the cause of Christ. Oh, how about Saul of Tarsus? He'd be great. After all, he's just trying to kill us. Well, the Lord came to him on the road to Damascus and transformed him into the most powerful and effective missionary, apart from Jesus himself, that has ever lived. Jesus changed these people, and they changed the world. You know, I've said many times, I say this frequently in my classes at the school, Jesus took 12 truly committed disciples and changed the world with them. You know, when Jesus left this earth, there was no church. He left the entire thing in the hands of these people. And then I look out and I start counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Sorry, didn't get you in the apostles. I could keep counting, couldn't I? If Jesus could do that with 12 people who possessed the characteristics and attributes those guys did, which were not exactly worthy of boasting, what could he do with this bunch? Rather than saying, ooh, wasn't it impressive what he did back then? Do we still serve that God? Has he diminished in any way his power and ability to use people for his purposes? If the answer to both of those questions is clear to you, then the answer to my next one ought to be clear as well. Can he change the world today? And the answer to that is yes. Will he? Part of that depends on you. Jesus changed people that he interacted with. And we expect that. I remember saying when I was younger, oh, if only I could have lived when Jesus did, wouldn't that have been marvelous? And it would have. I don't want to diminish that in any way. If I could have known the Lord Jesus personally on this earth, what an honor. But I think implicitly, I sometimes have used that as an excuse. I've said, well, of course Jesus was profoundly impactful on those that he met personally, but, you know, he's not here right now. And so, It's different. Well, is it? Jesus is also remembered because He changed the lives of people who never knew Him. Didn't He? Before the end of Paul's life, he was able to claim that the gospel had been proclaimed to every creature under heaven. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 23. Now that's a big, bold claim. And even if you don't take that literally, in other words, was there a frog somewhere over on the outside of North America that hadn't heard about Jesus? That's not the point, is it? The point is, no one had been excluded. Everyone who was willing to had access to the message of Jesus Christ. And that included, of course, thousands of people, thousands upon thousands of people who did not know Jesus personally. As a matter of fact, if you know of somebody who was a Christian after AD 100, that person never met Jesus. And yet, His influence continues to be profound, not merely in the first century, but in the centuries to come. Much has been made of Emperor Constantine of Rome's adoption of Christianity in the 4th century, and people have given him credit for the popularity of the church and even the expansion of it in his day. I was doing some reading here a while back from a sociologist named Rodney Stark. If you ever have a chance to get the book, The Rise of Christianity by Rodney Stark, I'd encourage you to read it. Stark's not a Christian. He's not a believer in any sense of the word. He does say on one occasion in an interview I read that he wishes he was. He likes the sound of it. But he's not. He's not really a believer. And perhaps that gives even more weight to what he asserts. He says Constantine did not adopt Christianity and then it became popular. Exactly the opposite is the case, says Stark. Records seem to indicate that Christianity continued its explosive spread from the first century into the second, third, and fourth centuries. Constantine's a politician. What do politicians do? My apologies if there's a politician in the room right now. I'm sure you're a lovely person. What do politicians do? That's right. They jump on the bandwagon. I couldn't have said it better myself. They reflect public opinion to some degree, don't they? Or at least their perception of public opinion. They don't always reflect my opinion. But they reflect what their perception of public opinion is because they cannot effectively lead if at least a significant number of people are not behind them. Even a despotic king can't hang on for long without the support of those ruled. Constantine's no fool. He sees the way this is going. And so he adopts Christianity. Later on, a story is manufactured of a vision that he supposedly received. If you put the sign of the cross on your shield, you'll be victorious. So he does that. He wins. Decides to become a Christian. I'm not sure that story is even true. It has very little support in actual history. It's another one of those legends that comes down through us, through history to us. But the point that I want to make and that Stark makes is Constantine did not popularize Christianity. Constantine adopted Christianity because it was popular. We're talking about a movement, a church that expanded by a rate of percent unheard of since that time. There's never been anything else that happened like that. Stark attributes that, by the way, 30% per decade is the growth rate that appears to have been sustained by New Testament Christianity over the first 3 centuries of its existence. Stark says, here's why it happened, as best we can tell. The unique practices of the church were compelling. Intimacy in relationships, so much so that occasionally accusations were made against them of incest because husbands and wives were brothers and sisters. Accusations of cannibalism because they ate the body and drank the blood of Jesus as people distorted what was actually going on in the Lord's Supper. But their relationships were extremely intimate. Demonstrations of kindness and caring to strangers. Reports exist of Christians going out and finding babies on the garbage dumps. You see, the Romans had little regard for human life. If that baby was deformed or even was the wrong gender, they just dumped the baby. Christians would go out to the garbage dumps, find those babies, and raise them. At times of disease, two plagues struck the Mediterranean world in the 200 or 300 years following the life of Jesus. One of them appears to have been measles, and it doesn't seem like a big deal to us today, but it killed up to 1/3 of the population of the Roman Empire. Smallpox may well have been the other. At times like that, and remember, these are plagues which are killing people right and left, and we have renowned physicians, medical doctors of the day, leaving the area in fear. And much like the firemen and policemen that ran into the Twin Towers on 9/11 while others were running away, Christians were pictured as those who went in when others went out. And they gained the reputation of being people who cared so much for other people they would put themselves at risk. And that's a compelling example. Further, Stark says, and almost incidentally here, Stark says something else kind of neat happened when he says that some of those Christians developed immunity to those diseases and didn't die, though they were exposed to them continuously, and people thought it was a miracle. They saw God in that. Now, I'll not speak to whether or not God actually was preserving their lives. The point is this: when people saw Christians doing things that other people would not do, they saw God in that. And so people who had never met Jesus are profoundly influenced by Him through the lives of His servants. These people stood up for the weak and the powerless. They ministered to the sick at great personal risk to themselves, and the world took notice. As His first disciples had been, these disciples too were changed by their relationship with Jesus Christ, and they too changed the world. Third, Jesus Christ is remembered because He has changed even modern society. He's changed us. He's changed our world. He's changed people who have little interest in Him, yet He continues to influence and affect them. Please note the following examples of the profound impact of Jesus on the modern world. First of all, and quite obviously, the current world calendar reflects the advent of Jesus Christ into this world. Now, it's off by a few years, about 4 as best we can tell. But there's no doubt what the purpose of that was. The AD that follows the number of each year today stands for Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord. Now, there are movements out there to try to change that. For example, we'll see we use the term BC, before Christ. You see BCE frequently these days, before the Common Era. Those who are not real comfortable with the fact that our calendar has been for the last 1,500 years or so based on the coming of Christ. By the way, it didn't start immediately following His birth. About 600 years or 500 years after the time of Christ, someone suggested that the calendar be dated from that time, and since that time it has been. Prior to His coming, the Jews counted time from creation, or at least as best they could estimate it. And the Romans began their calendar with the establishment of the city of Rome. The Greeks marked time from the first Olympic Games. The birth of Jesus, however, brought people together under one system and stands as the hinge of history in many respects, not only spiritually and morally, but also even chronologically. Second, many societies base their government system on Christian principles. The vast majority of those who signed the Declaration of Independence and framed the U.S. Constitution were unabashed Christians. Now, you can define that term however you want to. We would not have been able to agree with many of them on a number of different things. But one thing's for sure, they believed they were doing the things they were doing because they believed that Jesus Christ would approve of those things. The language these documents contain and the ideas they promote indeed are indebted to Christianity in significant ways. Indeed, each of us is indebted to the teachings of Christ as they've transformed the world into a much more congenial place to live. Nations around the world have looked to the U.S. Constitution as a model when they've set up their own governments, thus continuing the influence of Jesus' teachings. I'm not here to tell you that everything that we see in the laws of our lands across the world owe their origination to the teachings of Jesus. But only a fool would attempt to deny that he was extremely influential, that his teachings were extremely influential and continue to be. And you know what's really ironic about that? Is those things continue to be influential and beneficial in the lives of people who despise it. They despise Jesus. They treat him as if he's worthless, yet every single day they are the beneficiaries of the fact that he taught what he taught, and the impact that he had has been so profound. The teachings of Jesus, number three, have had a profound and major impact on human and civil rights around the world. Without the influence of Christian principles, man's cruelty to man runs amok. It is not difficult to find examples of what happens when man abandons a spiritual and religious compass. And even the acts that are perpetrated in the name of religion, sometimes even in the name of Christian religion, are instead the ideas of human beings, are intensely destructive. Seneca, a Stoic philosopher and a contemporary of the Apostle Paul, wrote these words. He says, "We strangle a mad dog, we slaughter a fierce ox, we plunge the knife into the sickly cattle lest they taint the herd. Children who are deformed or weakly, we drown." Were you paying attention there? In the Roman way of looking at things, there is little difference between a human being and an animal. And when we devalue life in that way, we can give ourselves permission to do almost anything. By contrast, Christianity has continued to call societies to a higher standard. Abortion was rampant during the church's early years, but Christian women were not subjected to that. In fact, Christianity had a very positive influence on the status of women in every culture where it has been found. Christianity gets kind of a bum rap today, as if Christianity is putting its thumb on women, not allowing them to take positions of leadership, for example, in the church or in the family, beyond what the New Testament has mandated. But make no mistake, the very people who are making those claims today do so as beneficiaries of the liberating influence of New Testament Christianity on women. When Paul makes the statement, "We are all one in Christ Jesus, regardless of whether we are Jew or Greek, male or female, bond or free," it's difficult for me to stress too heavily just what a profoundly revolutionary statement that was. For much of human history, women have been little more than property. And for that reason, Christianity is unique and different. When Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 28 is followed, women are not mistreated. Stark says, "Christian women had tremendous advantages compared to women next door." Slavery, while not specifically forbidden in the New Testament, was clearly at odds with Christian teaching. And Winkler, Wendell Winkler, says in an article he wrote, "Though the New Testament does not say thou shalt not own slaves, wherever it has gone, slavery has ceased." Jesus' teachings, like the Golden Rule, make slavery untenable. The list could go on and on. Everything from art and literature to education in the home had been profoundly impacted by the life and teachings of Jesus. It's ironic then that our society today seems more and more bent on minimizing the impact of Christ. Even as they proudly proclaim they do not want Him or do not need Him, they are benefiting from a world order undeniably indebted to principles extracted from His teachings. As Winkler declares, "There is not an infidel alive of any stripe who would want to live where the influence of Christ has not gone." Indeed, Jesus has been remembered throughout all generations, from the first century to the 21st, not because He sought immortality for Himself, but because He sought it for us. Not because He erected a colossal monument to His own accomplishment, but because He has gone to prepare a mansion for us. Not because of who He thought He was, but because of who we know He is. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, let us do our part to remember and to make sure that He is remembered in every generation until He comes. Thank you all for your kindness. I appreciate your attention. May God bless you all.